Hello, I'm Tippi Hedren, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom. Welcome, everyone, to the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air. My name is Rabbi Saul Solomon, and I am thrilled, excited, and delighted to be talking to a movie star, a woman who has appeared in movies directed by Alfred Hitchcock, and a movie directed by Charlie Chaplin. Plus, she was in Citizen Ruth and I Heart Huckabees. Her style of acting has influenced everyone from Bridget Fonda to Naomi Watts. And she is the mama of Melanie Griffith and the mother-in-law of Antonio Banderas. And she's also very involved in the safety of large and dangerous animals. We'll talk about that too. I'm a small and not so dangerous animal, Rabbi Saul. Thrilled again to be welcoming Tippi Hedren to the neighborhood. Shalom, Tippi.
Well, shalom, Rabbi. It's so nice to talk to you.
You too. You as well. So, darling, let me ask you a question. Where did you get the name Tippi from? It was from your dad, but what was he thinking? Was Tupsa something like that?
Tupsa.
Tupsa.
Yeah, it was my baptismal name is Nathalie, with an H, Nathalie K. Hedren. And that was just a little bit much for a little tiny baby. So he started calling me Tupsa, which is a Swedish term of endearment, apparently.
Oh, and Tupsa somehow morphed.
It went from Tupsa to Tips to Tippi.
To Tippi, and you decided to keep that as a Hollywood act. Did you feel it helped you, held you back, or was it just a name?
I have no idea. I was very, very pleased that when I went under contract to Alfred Hitchcock, that he never mentioned changing my name.
Yes,
so I didn't have to deal with that, which was wonderful.
No,
I like the name. I've always been called that, so it works for me.
It works for all of us. It has for many years. Now, Hitchcock was kind of the first director. That you had done any acting before going into The Birds and Marnie?
Oh, well, when I was a model in New York from 1950 to 1961, I was with the very fabulous Eileen Ford Agency.
Well, of course.
And, you know, in the 50s, the television set usurped our lives. And along with that came the advent of the television commercial, which was fabulous. And I did a tremendous number of them. It was not only a wonderful job, but it was also financially lucrative, so much so that I was able to take 6 months off and go around the world.
Oh, what a life! And this is back then, before supermodels, before the TV commercials, and TV was an enormous sum. It was pretty expensive, or well-paying back then.
Yes, we were the beginning of it all. We were the pioneers.
Now, can I ask you, do you remember any commercials, specific commercials that you did, or jingles or taglines that you had to deliver?
Something I did so many. The one that Alfred Hitchcock saw me was, it was a pet milk product called Seago. And it was more of a storyline. It wasn't just holding up a product or, something like that. It was a storyline, and there was a part of the commercial was a little boy whistles at me when I'm walking down the street. And apparently Hitch and his wife, Alma, saw the commercial, and they decided to find out where the girl was, who she was. And I had just 2 months before moved back to California so that my daughter, Melanie, she was 4 years old then. And, it's important for children to be able to have some kind of independence, such as, Mommy, I'm going out to play.
Right.
And I wanted her to have that rather than living on the streets in New York where you cannot let your child go out to play, So anyway, I had just moved back and I had expected my career to go on as it had in New York, and it wasn't doing so well, and I'm thinking, oh boy, what do I do now? I don't type.
Wow.
So on Friday the 13th of October in 1961, I received a phone call from Universal Studios asking if I was the woman in the Seago commercial, and that's how it all started.
And then you were basically handpicked by Alfred Hitchcock when he saw you on TV. He said, I want that girl. You became his next muse, as it were, and it led to The Birds. Now, gotta ask, do you remember scenes or doing that when, I mean, a lot of it is special effects, but there were moments when he really probably had to terrify you, and you got birds really coming at you. Do you remember any of that?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, the you know, people talk about special effects in terms of today's capabilities, and they didn't exist all those years ago. And you know, we did this movie in what, 62, I can just imagine what would happen now, because and it would be very phony and all of that. But we used real birds. The scene of which you would be talking was the scene where I go up those stairs at the end of the film. And I asked Alfred Hitchcock at that time, why would I do that? Why would I go up there all by myself?
And he said?
He had never thought of that. He said, because I tell you to.
It's what all critics of horror movies point to. They say,
dramatic motivation.
Why don't they just leave the haunted house? No, they go in there with a flashlight and they get killed. Why don't they just run? You know, but yeah, okay. Because the director said so. And then when he went up the stairs, what did he do to get a reaction from you on film?
Well, when I opened the door to, you know, to find out what the noise was that I was hearing, and all of a sudden all of these birds attack, and I said, Mr. Hitchcock, when I first read the script, how would we be doing that scene?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, it won't be a problem. We'll use the mechanical birds like we do with the when the children are working.
Oh.
Fine. And you know what? They all lied to me. The entire crew lied to me the whole time. And I didn't know about the fact that they were using real birds until the morning we started filming. It was a Monday morning. And the assistant director came into my dressing room and he said, he couldn't look at me. And, you know, we'd been working together for a long time. I said, what's the matter with you, Jim? He kept looking at the floor, the walls, and the ceiling. And he said, the mechanical birds don't work. We have to use real ones. And out the door he sailed.
And did he know, like, days before, or?
They knew all along. And I went out to the set, and there was no intention of using mechanical birds. There wasn't a mechanical bird around, but there were boxes inside a cage around the door that I come in. They had put a cage around it, and inside the cage were four boxes of raven, seagull, gull. There is no such thing as a seagull. Gull, and...
Actually, I know a lot of people named seagull, but yeah, continue. So, but was
a few pigeons thrown in, and three bird trainers with gauntlets up to the leather gauntlets up to their shoulders, and which they sailed at me for a week.
Oh my. So it was kind of scary, even though birds don't really, you know, they're not like, as you say, wild tiger animals, but still, you have 3 dozen birds coming at you, flapping and screeching and pecking.
Oh, yes, and they do, and the gulls actually were quite dangerous.
Oh.
Yeah, they weren't very nice at all. And, of course, any wild animal has the capability of hurting you.
Yeah. Now, at that point on that film, Hitchcock was still basically a gentleman to you. I mean, he was still the director,
he was
the king.
Oh, yes, but, and it was wonderful, you know. And coming in like that with having no acting behind me, I was a novice. And so Hitchcock and his wonderful wife, Alma, became my drama coaches.
And also, I read an interview.
Fabulous.
I read an interview with you where you learned something really, really interesting from Jessica Tandy on that film about acting. Can you tell that story?
Yes. In fact, I think she literally saved the movie. I don't know if you remember the scene where, after she has been horribly hurt by seeing that the farmer who had been killed by the birds, And, I mean, she was really, really hysterical. And I go into her bedroom to bring her some tea as a comforting kind of thing. And, you know, she really didn't like me. She didn't like my character. You know, she didn't want her son to be taken away from her. Because she really didn't want to be alone. And so anyway, when we were doing the scene, prior to doing it, Hitchcock said to me, "I want you to be very bitchy in this scene." And I said, "Oh, all right, that's odd, but okay." And so I was. And when and then we went on to other scenes after that was over. And the set was taken down, and when it was assembled, Jessica Tandy watched it with Hitch.
She watched the rushes, in other words, yes.
Went to the dailies when things are edited and all of that. I don't know why I wasn't included in that. I don't know. I must have been doing something else, because he always included me in those things. And after she saw the scene, she looked at him and she said, "Hitch, nobody's going to like that girl. I did such a good job of being bitchy."
Well, right, but the problem is then you have a protagonist that people don't really care about.
Meanwhile, the set has been put away, we were on to other things, he brought the set back, and we did it over. So here we have the same set, the same script, the same actors, everything that was previously done, but I did the scene with compassion and, a real caring. And that was a really good lesson for me.
Because you hadn't really done much acting until then.
Know what you can do with a scene.
Yeah.
How you can completely change it. I mean, it would have changed the whole movie. And it was because of Jessica Tandy and Hitch listened to her.
Right, of course. And the thing was, she went to him, and he went to you. She didn't go directly to you, because he probably would have objected to that. But she did the right thing. She went,
absolutely,
to the top down.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of people changing, the relationship between Hitch and you changed in the second movie that you did together, Marnie.
Yes.
Now, people can say, well, maybe he was just kind of preparing you for the role and treating you differently because it was a different kind of a character, but there was something else going on there, right?
Yes, there was. Yeah, I didn't know at the time, but apparently Hitch had romantic notions about many of his actresses, and but nobody ever talked about it.
Right.
I mean, it was really sort of, but that was the old studio system. I was at the end of that.
Right, and the director expected or hoped for or whatever. I mean, even today, directors will have a muse, sort of this untouchable ideal of a beautiful actress that they'll put in a film, and their way of being with that actress is making the movie, but they won't be able to do more than that, than they understand it. But back in the old studio days, maybe directors expected more, if you know what I'm saying. Maybe Hitchcock.
Men have been obsessed with women for millennium.
True.
This isn't anything new. It isn't anything unique to the motion picture business. The only thing that is unique about it is a glamorous business. And, it puts a different spin on it. But, as a fashion model in New York, but in any business, women are hit on.
Well, hit on is
and
one thing,
always.
But,
I mean, this isn't anything new.
No.
And when it finally got so impossible for me, his demands on me became really impossible. I became very, very clever at getting out of situations.
So he would ask you to
what? Was really good at it.
Well, what would be an example of what he would ask you to do or to get you away somewhere?
Oh, well, it was, at first it was his assistant would come to me and say, "Mr. Hitchcock would like to have a glass of champagne with you after the day's over." Mm. I thought, all right.
Oh.
And then it became more and more, those requests became more prevalent. And I have a daughter. I wanted to go home. And so I would do that. I'd say, I'm sorry, I can't. I have to go home and take care of my daughter. But eventually it got to the point where I really couldn't stand it. And I was supposed to go to New York to accept an award on The Tonight Show. It was the Photoplay Award. And so I went to Hitch and said, I would really like to take, this was at the end of filming of Barney, and it was an accolade for my work in The Birds, and I really wanted to go, and I thought it was important, and I thought it would be good for publicity for Barney, you know, and I said it would just take a couple of days, and he looked at me like I was asking for the world. And completely rejected that request. And I said, but I think it's really important. And then he laid this demand upon me that I was so shocked and so repulsed.
Ooh.
That I said, I have to get out of this contract. When Barney is over, I am done. I want out. And he said, well, you can't. You have your daughter to support. Your parents are getting older. And I said, none of them would want me to be in a situation in which I'm not happy. I want to get out.
What the hell did he ask for? I'm wondering. What did he demand of you?
Well, it's obvious, isn't it?
But he couldn't put that in a contract.
No, he couldn't. But he did keep me under contract. He paid me my $600 a week for almost 2 years.
All right.
He said, I'll ruin your career.
And he didn't quite, but it didn't, after Barney, it was not so great for you in a sense of high-level, big movies. So it did, he did hurt you.
I'll tell you something, but he did no publicity on Barney.
Mm.
None.
Just because he was punitive.
He really wanted to ruin me.
Wow. Wow, that's
after I got out of The Birds and Barney, I was, as the Hollywood expression, hot as an actress. And directors and producers wanted me, but to get to me, they had to go through him. And he said, she isn't available.
Now, can I ask you a question? Hitchcock, I mean, his script supervisor, his helper, his wife, Alma Revel, should have been around a lot since he was making these movies. Could you have gone to her and said, your husband, he has issues?
She already knew that. She was aware of that. She'd been through it many times before. And in fact, one day she came to me and she said, just out of the blue, she said, Tippi, I'm so sorry you have to go through this.
Wow.
I looked at her and I said, Alma, you could stop it. And her eyes sort of glazed over and she turned around and walked away.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's... Wow.
And so, whatever. That whole relationship was an enigma to everyone in Hollywood.
Well, let's move to another director that you did work with, and someone who also had, in a different way, his eye on the ladies, someone who did have a lot of relationships with his lead actresses, but...
Well, so did Hitchcock. He did, too.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess. Well, I didn't know. I thought he wanted to, but it was always sort of...
Well, apparently he, I don't know how successful he was, but and this goes all the way back to when he was doing silent films. The one that I recall hearing about was the actress Annie Andra, who he worked with in several of his...
I assumed it was generally... unrequited.
But back a long time.
Yeah. Whereas, well, I'm bringing up Charlie Chaplin now, who was a very charming, attractive, man. So, in a different way, he would be after his leading ladies, but it was not a stalkery thing. It was kind of mutual. But that's just the leading...
Well, I didn't have that relationship
right.
with him.
Fair enough. But I do want to know what it was like being in a film directed by him.
Oh, it was fabulous. And the difference in their methods of directing were so opposite. Hitchcock knew exactly what he wanted from his actors. Everything was so well planned. And it was, you know, it was the kind of thing that had spoiled you from working with other other directors.
And by the way, we should mention...
He literally worked from 9 to 5. At 5 o'clock, we did our martini shot.
That's
I mean, wonderful. It was, most directors will work until... and many directors will take 20 takes and, you know, all these lengthy, you know, for what, I don't know. But anyway, Hitchcock, sometimes all he'd do is have three takes. And he knew so much about of what he wanted. And after the discussions we would have with the character, with the scenes, with the whole play, all of us knew exactly what he wanted.
Wait, are you talking Hitchcock now or Chaplin?
Yeah. Hitchcock.
Hitchcock, okay.
And Charlie, on the other hand, he would get on the set, and he would act out all of our different roles.
Wow.
Really. And then he'd say, okay, now you all do it. And now here we are working with the great method actor, Marlon Brando. Marlon did not appreciate this.
Oh.
Not at all. He wanted to quit.
Was he respectful, though? By the way, the name of the film is The Countess from Hong Kong. I don't think we mentioned that. But was he, I mean, he was unhappy. Being Brando, did he explode? Or did he always realize, hey, it's Charlie Chaplin?
No, he was very professional about it. He just, he took care of it between himself and Hitchcock.
And how was
overt, no.
How was your relationship with Brando? I mean, when I say relationship, I just mean working, friendship, whatever.
Oh, he was terrific. He was absolutely terrific. He made the play for me, you know, but that...
Now, wait a minute. Every woman would have glad... I mean, Elaine Stritch would have glad... Why did you resist Marlon Brando?
Because I was a married lady.
Oh, you were married? Okay, you were still... Got it.
Well, I wasn't. I was about to be married.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, so you were an engaged lady.
Yeah,
fair enough.
I was.
Fair enough. Oh, wow. Okay. Now, let me ask, by the way, we're talking with the delightful Tippi Hedren, the actress, and I'm curious about other directors that you have worked with and their particular styles, so feel free to think of someone that you loved working with or hated. Either way.
Yeah, I've been able to work with some incredible directors.
And actors, too, as a matter of fact. Are there any particular fun anecdotes of other people that you have worked with that we would know their names?
Well, you would know Sean Connery.
I heard of him, yes. Yes,
yes you have. I'm
is
sure.
He as great as everybody thinks he is?
And Rod Taylor.
Oh, wow. Well, do you have any memories?
Marla Sophia Loren.
Good Lord.
Yeah, which is fabulous.
But more than even just saying their names, do you have any recollections or fun stories or anecdotes?
Well, with both Rod and...
Sophia or the other one, or Sean Connery.
And Sean, Hitchcock had made it very, very clear to them. Apparently they were told, you will not touch the girl.
Well,
I was called the girl every now and then.
The girl. Well, that was probably the name of the act, what he would call all of them at a certain point. All the blonde, musy ladies.
Oh, I don't know what he called all of them. I have no idea.
Now, speaking of girls, I do have to ask about one movie that you were in that was pretty, I would say, brave for you to be in, and fairly brave for its time, even though it was a changing generation. But you were in a film called The Harriet Experiment. Which I recall being fairly controversial because I had nudity and it was...
Oh, it was, indeed.
Yeah. Did you have any hesitations about being in a movie that was pushing the boundaries for a commercial film at the time?
No, it wasn't that I agreed with the morals and all of that, which there practically weren't any in that movie.
Right.
But it was a sign of the times. You know, that I think it was the beginning of all those years ago, it was the beginning of a change of attitude about, sexual freedom. And, when you do a film, there were a lot of films that I turned down because I didn't didn't want to be involved with them, but...
What's an example, if you don't mind? What's a movie that you turned down, and you were like, no, morally, this bothers me, and it could have turned out into a flop or a great hit? What might be a movie that you said no to?
Actually, I don't even remember them.
Okay.
I don't even remember them, because it was the kind of thing you read the script and say, no, I don't want to do that.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. And what about movies that you really wanted or tried out for that you didn't get, and you kick yourself or you kick the director and say, oh, if I only had that one?
There would probably be a lot of them. I don't, you know, so you were, I don't live in the past.
That's great.
I really don't. I don't dwell on the past. I don't, I don't live in, I wish I had, had I only done this, had I only done that. It's not that I don't learn from those kinds of things, but I don't.
That's a wonderful way of looking at things. And I, as you say, you turn down certain things for moral reasons because you were raised Lutheran. How religious are you? Since I am a rabbi, I am curious, how religious are you or were you? Do you have any still connection to going to church, etc.?
My parents, all of my ancestors were Lutheran and came from Sweden as Lutherans and were very, very staunch in their beliefs. And my sister, Patty, and I were both raised in the religion of Lutheran belief.
And what about now? Are you just spiritual, or do you follow, as it were?
Oh, yes, I do.
Oh.
I mean, in all of the, everything I learned from my teachings from the Lutheran faith have been very effective for me. And
What might be an example of
very
that?
Very important. Well, for one thing, the big example is the fact that I had the guts to say no to a very, very important man in a career in which I had just begun.
Hmm.
And, when you say no to somebody like that, you stand the chance of losing a lot. And, any of the women out in your audience who are going through something like I went through with being and it is abuse when you are put into these kinds of situations.
Just ask all the women in my congregation. Just kidding, I'm kidding. No, but seriously.
No, but yeah. I mean, so when these things happen to you. And I can only encourage every woman out there who is facing this kind of an issue to get out. Just get out of it. No matter what you have to do, you may lose something, you may lose a lot. I certainly did.
Mm.
You know, I was stopped from a career. He ruined my career, but he didn't ruin my life.
You kept yourself respecting. Eventually,
yes,
your career picked back up, and you started doing lots of movies. As I mentioned, I Heart Huckabees. Hey, what was it like working with Dustin Hoffman? I'm curious.
Oh, fabulous.
I figured.
Yeah.
I just assumed, you know, and Citizen Ruth, was that with Laura Dern? Who was in
Citizen? Yes.
Yeah, how,
yes.
What, was she wonderful? Was she delightful?
Yes, she was. She was absolutely fabulous.
Wonderful.
And this was her first break, and she was brilliant.
Now, you also, this will transition into the other topic that we'll be talking about with Tippi Hedren here in the neighborhood. You were in a movie a long time ago called Roar.
Yes.
Now,
that changed my life.
First
changed my life, and so did Roar.
Now, how did Roar, hint, hint, change your life?
Well, I was doing two films in Africa in 1969 and 1970. And during those years, environmentalists all over the world were telling us, people of the world, that if we didn't do something right then to save the wild animals from encroaching civilization, sport hunting, poaching, by the year 2000, there would be no lands left or animals left in the wild. So there was a lot of awareness going out, and my then husband was a producer. And we decided to do a film about the animals in the wild. And kicking around ideas, We went to on a photo safari in Mozambique, and on the Gorongosa Game Preserve, there was a house that had been abandoned by a game warden because it flooded during the rainy seasons. He moved out, and a pride of lion moved into that house. It grew to be the largest pride in all of Africa. There must have been 25, 30 lions of all sizes living in that house. They were sitting in the windows like great portraits. They were going in and out the doors, napping on the verandas. The cubs were playing out in front. It was delicious. You couldn't get near that house. Well, I guess you could.
Some would say the oatmeal was too hot. The others would say it was too cold. But most of them, the oatmeal was
just right.
So anyway, we chose
the lion and tiger. We got back to California. The script was written and handed the script to the different trainers of these Hollywood acting animals. And they all came back with laughing at us, saying, "You can't do this movie." And we said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because of the numbers of animals you have working together." And we said, "Well, that's the way they were living in Africa," which is, of course, an entirely different thing.
Sure.
But he said, "There's an instinctive dictate to fight a cat they don't know. I don't want my cat hurt. I don't want to be hurt. Get your own animals to do the movie." Well, that's a romantic notion. But that's how it started, with one little lion cub that we rescued. Then there were two. Then there were 10. Then there were 25. And we had to board them someplace, so we boarded them with one of the trainers who had told us we couldn't do this movie. And eventually, in 1980, we bought the property after a while because the mortgage was more than the...
Sure.
What we had to pay was more than the mortgage, so we bought the place. And in the 80s, we had over 150 big cats here that we had rescued.
Now, that's kind of... I mean, it's a little bit confusing here, because your point is to keep these animals away from humans, but at the same time, you gotta have humans who are treating them and giving them shots. I mean, it's kind of a dangerous thing, isn't it?
It is extremely dangerous, and of course, the more we got to know the animals, the more we learned about them and how really dangerous they are. And all those years, because this started in 1972, and our movie took 5 years. We had 8 people injured.
Oh,
two of them almost killed.
Didn't your daughter get bitten at one point?
Yes, bitten, attacked.
Wait, how old was she?
Well, how old was who?
Your daughter, when she was attacked. Melanie.
Oh, her little face was scratched.
By a what? By a lion?
A lion, a young lion, uh-huh.
Okay, that's rather terrifying. My God,
yeah, you
that's
bet it
traumatic.
Is. I was bitten in the back of the head. My then husband was had been hurt by the lions, and mostly lions, so often that they were going to name a wing at the Palmdale Hospital after him.
Oh, give up!
Our DP was almost killed. He was scalped because of the way we were doing a scene. We had to dig a pit, and
how much insurance did you have on that?
Oh, huge!
Oh my, didn't you think of walking away from the film after a while?
You know what? It is really interesting that we finished the film. It's amazing that we finished
it. Yeah.
But at the same time, I was getting an education, and it really took me by surprise and very seriously. Why the United States allows these apex predators, top of the food chain, one of 4 of the most dangerous animals in the world, to be bred and sold to be a pet or to be in some show. It really hit me very, very seriously, and I thought, nobody else is trying to change it. All the big animal organizations, nobody was doing anything to change this atrocity. And so I co-authored a bill, and it was a baby step to just stop the interstate traffic of these animals to be sold as a pet or for financial gain. I took it to my own congressman. He was hesitant at first, but I had put together a 4-minute video of this whole business, and the business is huge. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, it's on a par with illegal drugs.
I guess very, very rich people who have everything.
No, you can buy a lion for $1,000.
What?
You can buy, you can. You go to a swap meet, look in the newspaper, on the internet.
You can buy a dachshund or something like that, a little AKC dachshund pup that you can get in the classifieds. I don't see anybody selling a lion in the classified ads.
They're there. Oh, yes, it's huge. It's a huge business. And when it gets to be very, very big, it becomes dangerous. It's a dirty business. And when I was working on my first bill that I was talking about, the Captive Wildlife Safety Act, my life was threatened, and seriously threatened, and they were going to bring illnesses and diseases into the Shambhala Preserve to harm the animals. And I called the authorities, they came in and listened. These people are very tough, but they're not very smart. They left the threat on my answering machine.
And was it traceable through, like, their phone number? I mean, they found
it? Yes, it was, and the authorities came in and they said, yes, Tippi, this is serious, and this is what you can't do. For until we get this person, you are not a free woman. You cannot go out by yourself. If you drive, you have to have a rented car, somebody with you. Before you get back into the car to go back to Shambhala, you have to check under the car to see that nobody has planted a bomb.
Can't
answer the phones. We'll have to have the sheriff come here and go through everybody's bags before they come into the preserve. And it was serious. And then they brought in the FBI, and they got him.
Oh, good. Thank God.
They got him. He was an animal dealer from New Jersey.
Figures.
And I don't know what happened to him. You know, they never tell you.
Actually, what you should have, instead of all that protection from the FBI, you should have just walked around with two tigers. Nobody's going to come
what a good idea. Why didn't I think of
that? But when you say that, and the reason, like I said, these rich people who have everything, I think it was Mike Tyson who walked around with a panther on it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's dumb. It's a risk. Because 99 times out of 100, nothing's going to happen. But that one time, it's a wild animal. It's what happened with Siegfried and Roy.
Absolutely right. And there is nothing short of a bullet to the brain that can stop them.
Ay, ay, ay. Well,
very frightening. It's an animal that, you know, and everybody wants one. I mean, when you look at those little cubs...
I don't want a tiger! I don't want a lion! I mean, I don't want that! No!
But, Rabbi, how many people, when they go out to the impulse of, oh, let's go get a puppy, how many of them say, okay, what kind of puppy is this? Is it a lap dog? Is it a hunter?
Mm.
Is it a border collie that needs tons of exercise? How big is it going to get? How much is it going to eat? What is going to be required of my taking care of that animal? They don't even ask about a dog. So when they look at this adorable, darling little lion cub, I've got to have that.
Well, can I ask you...
And all of a sudden, they have an animal who is growing like you blow up a balloon and is dangerous.
Well, yeah. But let me ask, since we talked about puppies, this is a little more close to home with millions of people rather than a few hundred who might be wanting cubs and things like that. But what about pit bulls? I have an issue. I don't think pit bulls should be pets. Because they're a more dangerous breed of dog. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a huge issue about the pit bull. I have a friend, Linda Blair, who rescues pit bulls.
Well, Linda Blair from The Exorcist, right?
And she's in Acton also. She is trying to defend the pit bull, that it's the way they are trained, the way they are brought up, that makes them dangerous. And actually, in point of fact, you can make anybody dangerous. You can make
sure.
A human being dangerous by the way it's treated. So it's a dichotomous kind of conversation because the breed of the pit bull is very strong.
Right.
And
the jaw, the teeth.
You could teach a little toy poodle to be vicious. It harm you too much, but...
Right, exactly. My argument is, if you make a poodle mean, he bites you in the leg, you get a stitch, and then, you know, you give the poodle away. If a pit bull bites you in the leg, you're going to lose your leg. It's different. That's my take on it. I don't know. Do you come down on it either way, or are you still deciding?
About the pit bull?
Yeah.
Listen, I have my hands full with these lions and tigers. And Linda's doing a great job with taking care of them, and I have to leave that to her. But I do believe that it is the way many of the animals are treated or trained, and it's a horrible situation that I have to leave to somebody else, because I have my hands full. I not only have all of these animals to take care of, I have to raise $1 million a year, which amortizes itself out into $75,000 every month.
Good. Well, how do you do you have big dinners? Do you just go to really rich people? How do you raise $1 million a year?
With great effort. We ask for grants. We have events at the preserve. We have them off-site. There are so many different ways that we private donation. That's one of the most important.
Good. I mean, I'm glad that you're getting it.
If your audience would look us up on the website, Shambhala, Shambhala.org, and
Shambhala.org. Shambhala.org is the name.
And you will see how we take care of the animals, what our philosophies are about them, there's all kinds of information about the bill, the reasons why this bill is so important. The bill that I'm working on now is titled Big Cats and Public Safety Protection Act. And I have all of the reasons listed as to why. There's all of the accidents, the way so many of these animals are treated when people can't afford them, the hovels in which they live. I mean, it's a nightmare business. And I have also sample letters written that you can write to your congressmen and your senators to ask them to support the bill. And it's already been introduced by my congressman, Buck McKeon, and we have the Senate number and the House number. It was introduced by Richard Blumenthal in...
Nice Jewish boy. Okay, maybe. I'm just assuming. I don't know.
But it's so vitally important to get this passed. I mean, not one more child should be hurt or killed.
Or a grown-up.
One more human adult should be hurt or killed. These animals are dangerous.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm perfectly in agreement with you. I think even there are people who have issues with any animal being in any kind of captivity. That's a whole different thing. But certainly there should not be people walking around or having in their homes. I mean, I'm even against poisonous snakes being
absolutely.
You know, they get into apartments and suddenly through the drain pipe, oh, there's a rattlesnake. What the hell?
The whole issue of any wild animal being in... no wild animal should be a pet.
I
squirrel or your backyard or a Siberian tiger. Right. None of them should be pets.
Agreed.
And it's cruel to them. It's absolutely cruel.
Well, before we let you go, Tippi, if you have just another moment or two, I do want to ask Tippi Hedren one or two more questions that I'm sure our audience would love to know. First of all, there was a movie on cable made about Hitchcock and his relationships, with you, essentially, and it was about you. You saw the film. Was it
weird? Well, I was very much a part of it.
Oh.
It was done in England, produced by the BBC, and Gwyneth Hughes, who was the writer, asked if she would be able to consult with me about the film, and the film is absolutely true. She came out to Shambhala, and we spent hours and hours talking about this issue, and with Hitchcock, and you know, and it was such a dichotomous kind of thing because it was so wonderful, and I thought, oh, I am so lucky to have been given this opportunity, and then to have it turn into something so ugly and
wow.
And really sad. Anyway, the movie is absolutely right on.
But was it painful to watch for you, or could you distance yourself and say, well, that was me?
No, it was extremely difficult for me to watch. Hmm. HBO gave me a private screening in Beverly Hills, and after about 40 people, and my family came, and I was sitting next to my daughter, and when the film began, and Toby Jones was brilliant as Alfred Hitchcock, and when he first came on the scene and spoke, I grabbed my daughter's arm. I'm sure she's still bruised, because his portrayal of Hitchcock was so perfect.
Wow!
It was like the man had returned from the dead. You know, it was just.
And it gave you a moment of PTSD. It was post-traumatic. Like, oh my God!
You are absolutely right. Yes.
Wow.
Exactly what happened.
Wow. And on the opposite side of thing, about nice thing of someone that you're happy to see, I'm sure people are curious. You know, you are the mom of Melanie Griffith. She's married to Antonio Banderas. How often do you see them? Do you get together for Christmas? Do they come over?
Oh, yeah, we get together as often as we can. I live on the Shambhala Preserve, so, which is an hour away from L.A. You know, it all depends on traffic here. You know, we see each other as often as we can. And yes, the holidays we always spend together. And, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. And last question for Tippi Hedren. Did you give your daughter any kind of advice when she realized she was going to be an actress, she was going to go into this difficult business? What's one or two things that you told her?
You know what? It was like my parents. When you're young, you are given all kinds of ways of life that you can either accept or not, or you don't know anything. And I tried to be an example for my daughter, and of course had long discussions with her about issues. And same the thing that my mother did. Melanie went to Lutheran. She went to Lutheran school.
Right.
She also went to a Catholic school. But, you know, all the things that you learn as you're growing up. And
but there was a period when she...
Example is very important as well.
What is? I'm sorry?
You know, teaching your child by your own example.
Right. Although there was a period in her career when she was going a little, you know, off... Not off the edge, but, you know, she was in that mode where you probably had to be a little worried about...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, and that was dealt with.
Good. Thank God. I mean, you know, otherwise you didn't want her turning into Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, my God.
But she didn't. Thank God.
You know, so I saw a movie last week that I think everybody, when they're growing up and they first have their possibilities of doing drugs and alcohol, they should see this movie called Lost Weekend.
Oh, my God.
The Land.
Right.
You've seen it recently?
Not recently, but...
Well, I'll tell you something. It is exactly what happens, and it is so frightening, and it is that I think if young people could look at it and know that this is what would happen if you let it get a hold of you.
And you never...
Once it happens, yeah, it'll never go away. You are always, always an addict.
And you've managed,
addict,
I guess, because...
It's a very scary thought.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because you were raised so strongly in a Lutheran culture, and as you said, that way you never touched the stuff, it never became an issue for you of any...
No, it didn't. It didn't.
Mazel tov. And that's why, you know, you sound so incredibly together, and you look great, and you're having still this vital career, both as an actress and as a spokesperson and someone who cares about animals. I think it's wonderful. So let's remind everyone that it's Shambhala.org, was it?
.org for organization, O-R-G.
Right. Shambhala.org. All I can say is, Tippi Hedren, I only wish you many more years of success on both fronts and good health and only good things for you and your family.
Well, and I wish those things for you as well, Rabbi. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Shalom.
Shalom.